Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, Tom Crane, host of the KKFI program World Sounds Radio, will recall his time as a Peace Corps medical technician in Malawi many years ago and his impressions of the country then and now. This show was recorded on September 14th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. I'm Walt Wells. I'm a newer member of the Forum Committee, though an older member of the church. The Forum Committee organizes these interesting Sunday morning forums to discuss issues that are currently in the media, in our minds, and things that involve ethical issues in our world. Our speaker this morning is Tom Crane, who just coincidentally has a program,
World Sound Radio.
Okay, I was right. World Sound Radio on Sunday afternoons, hearing mostly contemporary African and other world music. Tom served in the Peace Corps a few years ago in Central Africa, in the country of Malawi, and took advantage of that time to travel, by his description, it sounds to me, rather widely in Central Africa. He knows it far better than I do. Simply talking with him, I have learned a lot about the continent. And without my taking up any more time, I will simply say, I think one of the first times I remember Tom was when he was bringing his sons here to Sunday school, and that's been 15, 20 years ago. So, anyway, Tom Crane.
Thank you, Walt. It's really great to be here and going to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, something that changed my life forever and changed my perceptions of how the United States itself fits into the world at large. And we're going to be talking to you about a little country called Malawi, which is about the size of Illinois and has a lake about the size of Lake Michigan, which is extremely deep. I think they finally figured out it's over 5,000 feet deep, and some of the most beautiful fish in the world can be found in aquariums around the world that come from the Great Lakes area of Africa, and Malawi is one of the Great Lakes of Africa. And I think I'd like to start out by quoting from a book here. I've read a lot of books about Africa, and the more I read, the more I realize I don't know as much as I thought I did. There's a whole lot to learn about the continent. You can fit two or more countries the size of the United States in Africa. It's a very huge continent. This is a book called Africa, A Biography of the Continent by John Reeder. And I'd like to start by quoting from, it's a 1997 book. It's subtitled A Biography of the Continent. In it, John says, Africa has been woefully misunderstood and misused by the rest of the world. Humanity does not recognize its debts and obligation to Africa. In Western imagery, Africa is the dark continent. And this dark continent does not only refer to the depths of Africa's equatorial forests, to the density of its tropical shadows, to the blackness of African skin, or even to the widespread lack of knowledge concerning the continent. Above all, the phrase tacitly labels Africa as the place where a very particular darkness is found, the darkness of humanity. In this context, Africa is where people do terrible things, not because the aptitude for such behavior is a characteristic of all humanity, but because Africa is believed to be inherently more barbaric and less civilized than the rest of the world. That people have behaved barbarically in Africa is undeniable, but as events in other parts of the world have demonstrated time and time again, this is not an exclusive African tendency. Civilization is not a predetermined consequence of human progress, as the Victorians believe, with white Anglo-Saxons leading the way, the rest of the world following in their wake, and the Africans struggling several centuries behind. And to live in Africa, particularly in southern Africa, which I did, you have to dispel some of these illusions of what Africa is and accept the fact that Africans share as much humanity as we do and have their own culture. Not all cultures evolve in a straight line, evolution. Some cultures evolve differently. And in Africa itself, in Malawi, which is a country, you can't quite see it. I'll show you the map here. And I guess you can switch to the next slide. Here we go. This is a small country in southeastern Africa, and it's one of the poorest countries in the world. There are 9 major ethnic groups, and about 20 or more languages are spoken in this small country alone. The official language is called Chichewa, and at the time I lived there, it was called Chinyanja. And the whole idea of Malawi came about during Livingston's history with it. It became a protectorate of the British Empire because in 1787, England set up a society for the abolition of the slave trade. And, of course, the slave trade persisted for many years past that. And Livingston was one of the people that was championing doing away with the slave trade. And if you notice, Malawi is kind of about half surrounded by a country to the south there called Mozambique. And Mozambique was a Portuguese territory, in which slavery was going on. And also, there were Arab settlements all along the coast of eastern Africa, and some people call it the Swahili coast. But there was also a great trade by the Arabs in slavery that went on, raiding deep into the interior. And Malawi itself became a protectorate as kind of a bulwark against slave raiding in Central Africa. And you can see the explorations went down to the bottom of Malawi there, and that's how Livingston and England set up the protectorate. Now, Malawi came out of a cultural misconception that Livingston himself had. He was the first European, maybe besides the Portuguese, to see Lake Malawi. And let's go to the next slide, and then we can see that there is a picture of Malawi right here. You see the size of the lake. It's almost as big as the country itself. That lake was pretty much unknown in Europe until Livingston found it. Well, he didn't find it because there are a lot of local people that knew it was there all along. But anyway, he went to the lake itself in the southern end and wanted to know the name of this lake. So he was asking a local person, what's the name of the lake? And saying it over and over again. Now, the local people didn't speak any English. They spoke a language called Yao or Chiao. And the answer, finally, the person he was interrogating answered him, oh, Nyasa, Nyasa. Well, so Livingston named the lake Lake Nyasa. Nyasa means lake. So it became Lake Lake, and it became Nyasa land, land of the lake. Later, after independence, the people understood this and changed the name back to the old name of the country. There had been a Moravi Empire of the Chewa people, another ethnic group in Malawi. So the name of the country became Malawi, and the lake became Lake Malawi. So it's no longer Lake Lake, it's Lake Malawi. And I'll give you a little bit of information here about Malawi from the Wikipedia article. For those of you who don't know, Malawi is officially the Republic of Malawi, and it's a landlocked nation in Southeast Africa, which was formerly known as Nyasaland. It's bordered by Zambia on the west, by Mozambique on the south, and Tanzania on the north. So it has three international borders. Malawi is over 118,000 or 45,000 square miles and has an estimated population of about 18 million as of July 2016. Now, when I was there, and I'm going to be showing you some pictures from the past of Malawi, when I was there, the population was around 4 to 5 million, and I was there over 40 years ago. So what you're going to be seeing from my pictures are pictures of the past, a past that doesn't really exist anymore. On the other hand, still frighteningly, some of it still does exist because Malawi is one of the poorest countries in the world. Lake Malawi takes up about half of Malawi's area. Actually, there's a border down the lake between Mozambique and up in the north. Most of the lake itself is in Malawi. And there's a little tiny island, if you look at the north up there, called Likoma Island, which is where one of the bases for anti-slavery activities took place. So that little island is in surrounded by Mozambique in the middle of the lake. It's kind of an anomaly of geography. And Mozambique, of course, has part of the lake on the east. The area of Africa known as Malawi was settled by immigrating Bantu groups and around the 10th century. And there was a great diaspora of people from Western Africa that spread throughout Southern Africa and East Africa, originally the Bantu-speaking peoples. And that's a big, large family of African languages. Centuries later, in 1891, the area was colonized by the British. In 1853, Malawi was then known as Nyasaland. And the biggest city in Malawi, which is kind of in the south there, way in the south, is called Blantyre. It's named after Livingston's hometown. And I had a chance to visit Blantyre in Scotland, which was kind of interesting. I got off the train there and walked through town. It was just a small little town. But the largest city in Malawi named after Livingston is Blantyre. And the capital of Malawi is more centrally located, and you'll see it in bold up there. It's called Lilongwe. And the country itself is divided into three provinces, the northern province, central province, and the southern province. And I lived at the extreme southern end of Malawi, at a place called Nsanji. You can barely see it there, on almost at the bottom. And it used to be called Port Harold, because this was the way that people could get goods back and forth down the Shire River, which is a major river, which flows into the Zambezi River and then eventually into the Indian Ocean. Malawi used to be, during colonial days, the English were good at setting up kind of coalitions or countries, you know, together. Like the East African Federation became Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya. And then in Central Africa, Malawi, or Nyasaland at that time, became part of what's called the Central African Federation, which consisted of Southern Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. And, of course, Malawi got independence in 1966, changed the name back. But it was part of the struggle, actually, against apartheid. There were leaders that were jailed because at that time, Malawi is looked at as a place of cheap labor where they would help Rhodesia or Southern Rhodesia in its factories and mines and South Africa. Zambia was looked at, which was Northern Rhodesia, was looked at as a source of resources. And, of course, Southern Rhodesia was where most of the whites lived. And they had set up a white-dominated government, which took a long time to dislodge. But The leader of Malawi was named Kamuzu Banda, who was educated. He was actually a doctor, a medical doctor, who was educated in England and became the first president of Malawi. Malawi today is among the world's least developed countries. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. I think when I was there, people made less than $100 a year, if you can imagine that. Today, it's probably up to $200 to $300 a year because most of the country is rural. Most of the country has people living in very rural areas who live on what they can grow. And if the rains don't come, if there's a infestation of crops of some type, then there is what's called njala, which means hunger, and people die. Now, Malawi also has one of the largest child mortality rates in the country, in the world. And the place that I live, and I'm not sure it's changed very much since then, in Nsanji, we estimated had a 60% child mortality rate. And if you don't know what that means, it means 6 out of 10 of your kids are going to die before they're 5 years old. So large families were the rule and still are, because it helps to have your kids work with you on the farms. And of course, if you're having that many kids die off, you need to keep the farms going somehow. Let's go on to the next one here. This is a picture of my Peace Corps group. I ended up going into the Peace Corps during the Vietnam era. And at that time, a lot of young men had to make a choice. Wait for the draft or your number to come up in the lottery, go to Canada, or do something else. And as a motivating factor, there was also this thing called the Peace Corps. And I was going to college in Iowa at the time, and I had heard about it. And it seemed to be an option to me. I ended up taking my physical, getting ready to be shipped over to Vietnam. But I also applied for the Peace Corps. And at that time, in the early days of the Peace Corps, you had to fill out this huge, long form and take a language ability test. You know, my language they gave me, they would give you some words, and you would have some time to memorize them, and then you would repeat them later on a test. The language they gave me was Kurdish, which was pretty interesting. So evidently, I did pretty well on that. And when I applied for I was really interested in the Andean cultures in South America, because I've read so much about the Inca Empire and how it worked. So I applied on my application for Peru, Ecuador, or Bolivia. Well, at the time I was taking my physical for Vietnam, I was student teaching in a little town called Keokuk, Iowa. And while I was student teaching, somebody came in the room with a telegram for me. And at that time, that's how they let people know if you were accepted in the Peace Corps or not. When I opened the telegram, it invited me to become a volunteer, Peace Corps volunteer, in the country called Malawi. Now, right away, and it was in Africa, which kind of changed my whole perception of where I was going to be going, if I was going anywhere. My students and I pulled out a globe and looked for Malawi. We couldn't find it, because on the globe it was called Nyasaland. So after a while of doing some research, I figured out where it was, and then they sent me information about it, and I thought, oh, okay, let's do that. And it was an invitation to join something called the Malawi Public Health Program, which was based at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And pretty soon, in June, I was flying to North Carolina, put up in a dorm there. We were training at the University of North Carolina for 3 months, training with 50 other people. And at that time, you weren't assured that you were going to get into the Peace Corps. Early days of the Peace Corps before me, they weren't really sure what President Kennedy had in mind, so they had volunteers doing the survival course, climbing ropes, you know, kind of like a basic training thing. And then they figured out, wait a minute, this isn't what we're doing. But anyway, we trained for 3 months at University of North Carolina. Started out with 50 people that had applied. And we trained at the School of Public Health because we were going to be working in something called the Malawi Public Health Program, and which was a TB, more like a TB research program of the University of North Carolina. And the idea was that we were going to go into rural areas, learn the language, and find links between hereditary links between TB, tuberculosis, and kinship. So we were training how to do research into kinship groups, census, trained how to ask questions, and also trained in how to provide health to the local rural inhabitants. We were trained in how to give what's called PPD, purified protein derivative shots, which would tell if somebody had TB or not. That was a part of the program to find out, after we'd done all this genealogical research, and we'd given injections of this PPD to people, to find out, and then we'd go back and read them later. I don't know if we've ever had one of these or not. I'm not sure it's a standard part of a physical anymore. But what happens is when you give the shot, you go back a week later and check the reaction. It's usually in the arm, and if there's a huge welt that shows up, or almost a blister or a raised area, this indicates a high exposure to TB. I've got so many stories here, I don't even know where to stop. So, but one particular thing really sticks in my mind. They decided to, as a part of this training, to have us actually give PPD shots. And they decided, okay, let's take them to a North Carolina mental hospital and give these poor patients these PPD injections. And I remember it was, I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called Snake Pit. Going into a North Carolina mental hospital at that time was just like that. It was a very scary experience. Anyway, we learned how to do that, and that was part of our training. And of course, the School of Public Health delighted in telling us and showing us the possible parasites we could get if we ate any of the local food, bringing out jars and, you know, pictures and horror stories. And I remember one of the professors saying, now, if somebody offers you food, pretend, are you giving me feces? And, of course, right away that set up a situation whereby if you went into a village and somebody who provided you food, you'd be a little bit scared of that. So that wasn't really a very good part of the training. Anyway, training was after 3 months, and then they had this thing called selection process. And I'm really getting off the Malawi subject here, but I'll get back to that in a minute. But the idea was halfway through the training, they would check to see if you'd make a good volunteer or if your attitude was right or why you were doing it. And then they would warn you that, okay, we're probably not going to select you to be in the Peace Corps. So you might as well go home unless you really improve your attitude or something like that. Well, anyway, they decided to throw a party for us at the end of training. And we each had a mailbox in our dormitory. And in that mailbox would be a letter saying whether you were deselected or not, which is pretty traumatic. You know, the people that stuck around after being told not to tried really hard to get in. So we went back after this party, which didn't turn much into a party at all because we didn't know what was going to happen to us. And everybody opened their envelopes and looked, and right away you figured out if you were in the majority or the people that were not going to be selected to be in the Peace Corps. And all through training, people would disappear. You know, it's like you'd be friends with somebody in a dorm, and then the next day their bed would be cleaned out and they'd be gone. So we ended up going overseas we started with 50 and ended up going over with 25. So about half the people didn't either left on their own or got deselected. And then of the 20, 20 stayed for the full 2 years, and 3 stayed for another extended term of another year. And I was one of those who stayed for the third year. But let's get back to Malawi here. I could talk all day on a million stories. This is our group. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Volunteers. It's kind of a comedy. And all through the movie, this group of Peace Corps folks are singing folk songs. And that's kind of what was going on. Whenever we took a bus somewhere, everybody would start singing folk songs. That was our group that went over in the late 60s. This is Lake Malawi. It's a very beautiful lake. It's a very huge lake. And you get out in the middle of it, like Lake Michigan, and you don't see land. It's so big. But all around the lake, if you notice, well, I showed you the map before. I don't want to go back to it, but both sides of Lake Malawi match each other. And it's during geographical and geological research, they figured out that Africa and South America once fit together. And if you look at the map, you'll see how they kind of fit into each other. Well, Lake Malawi, Lake Tanganyika, and some of the other lakes to the north are giant cracks in the earth that are spreading, which is why they're so deep. Lake Malawi is one of the deepest lakes in the world. Lake Tanganyika is a little bit deeper. I think it's around 7,000 feet deep. But the waters are clear and pure, and of course you want to be careful where you go swimming because there is a parasite called schistosomiasis or bilharzia, which you can get by contact. So let's go to the next one. This is more of the lake, and you can see on the opposite shore over there, way in the distance, are mountains. Because this is the southern end of the lake, you can still see the other side of the lake. But this is a giant crack in the earth, which is part of the Rift Valley system, which if you look at a map of Africa, Africa is coming apart along those lakes. And the eastern part in geologic time will split away from the rest of the continent. That's what Malawi and Tanzania are doing. And the lake provides a great source of protein. This is one thing that Malawi is lucky for. Unlike some other African countries that are landlocked, it has this source of protein, and fish is a great way to provide your family with some protein. And the way that people prepare this without refrigeration is they split the fish open and gut it, and then they dry it and smoke it. And then they put it on fish trucks and take it to markets all around the country. And if you're ever hitchhiking in Malawi, you don't want to take a ride from a fish truck. It smells pretty bad. Okay, next one. And these are dugout canoes. This is how people fish, and they use nets. Next one. And here's some folks on the shore in their dugout canoes. Now here again, these are pictures from the past. So there may, today that some folks may be able to afford an actual real boat. Well, these are real boats, but I mean a more modern or technological boat. Also, Malawi is known, some people would call it or have referred to it as the Switzerland of Africa. Well, they call that about Rwanda, too, for the simple reason. And let's go on to the next one here. Oh, there's a dugout canoe being created out of a tree. Okay, next one. But because Malawi has some magnificent mountains in it, all through the country, as a part of the Rift Valley, these things have pushed up. These are called Inselbergs. And if you've seen pictures of Rio de Janeiro with that magnificent Sugarloaf Mountain, this is the same kind of geologic thing that has happened there. These push up out of the landscape. These are not mountain chains. These are a result of tectonic activity. This is a 10,000-foot tall mountain, called Mount Malanje. And in my last year, that was a picture from my front door. Those cliffs there that go straight down are about 8,000 feet. And I've climbed Mount Malanje, not up the cliffs, but up valleys. and it's quite inexperienced. And there are plants that grow up there that don't grow anywhere else in the world. There's something called Mlanju cedar, which is a tree that's an endangered tree, and it only grows on this mountain. And all over different parts of Africa, you'll find these little isolated microclimate things where different types of vegetation and maybe even animals live that cannot be found anywhere else. And we can go on. And one of the things, there's another shot of Mount Mlanje. One of the things that keeps Malawi going is tea. The British found out that they could grow tea in the shadow of this mountain because of the rainfall. And of course, yes.
We're going to need to get the questions
answered. Okay.
So finish in a couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, why don't we just go through the slideshow real quick here, and you can put music on now. This is a tea plantation, and there's Mount Mlanje in the background. And that's me climbing Mount Mlanje way in the past. And there's some more pictures of it. You can see these valleys on the mountain turn into rivulets of rivers coming down from the mountain. Okay. And most people in Malawi are agriculturalists. This is how people would farm in the area that I lived in called Nsanji. And here is a woman out tending her garden. And, of course, corn or maize is a major thing. This is a tower in the mountains near where I lived because they would put a kid up there to watch out for baboons. Otherwise, their crop would get wiped out. These are some women coming to the market with their crops. And there's the market in Nsanji. Nsanji's probably the poorest part of the whole country of Malawi. If you notice, and there's a little girl sitting on the fence. And if you notice, the fence there is made of iron railroad ties. They couldn't use wooden railroad ties because termites would get them. Here are people laid out with sugar cane waiting for a bus to sell the sugar cane when the people get there. And there's another shot of the market. And here's a woman taking her crops to the garden, to the market as well. And this is a more well-developed town. This is Lilongwe. It's not as poor a town, an area as Nsanji. This is the market in Lilongwe, which is the capital of Malawi. And a lot of people would get their goods from stores that were run by Indians who were brought over during the construction of the railways by the British, and stayed to set up their own shops. And this is what you would find inside a typical Indian store. Now, there's resentment in the local population against the Indians because they would control a lot of the merchandise. There's a school, and you notice the kids are sitting under a tree there instead of under the school itself because it's so hot in the place I live that would be the best place for them to get their lessons. And, of course, kids are kids the world over. There's just some typical kids in the area that I lived. And kids have a great thirst for knowledge. These kids are studying a book, and these kids would come to my back door. My dad got me a subscription to Chicago Tribune, and it would arrive 3 months late. So these kids would show up and get the papers, and then they would use the papers to read or turn them into tobacco papers for cigarettes. This is the town I lived in. If you look in the center up there, you'll see kind of a white dot. That's the town of Nsanji. And you'll see a river that's winding its way through there. On the other side is Mozambique, and this side is Malawi. And you can see that on this side, there's a lot of farming going on, so the land has been cleared. And there again is the town of Nsanji with Mozambique on the other side and the Shiri River. This is the house I lived in. It was a civil servant's house in the town of Nsanji. Fortunately, it had a toilet and running water in the back from a pipe. And this is the town barber in Nsanji. Well, one of the town barbers setting up under a tree. Nsanji has no paved roads, or didn't back then. This is a flame tree, beautiful tree. This is was an old cotton gin that the British set up. I always like to look at this picture. And there it is again. And of course, where I lived, there was a lot of swamp, and I think it was the capital of mosquitoes. This is some of the Indian shops that were in the town that I lived in. And this is a town, this is near Malanje where I lived, and this is a little hotel, Migoi Inn. And these are the patients that I dealt with. They have in front of them, I learned how to take x-rays and read them, and of course we didn't have a doctor at the hospital I was at first, so I prescribed medicine and diagnosed TB from the x-rays and started people on treatment. This is the TB ward in the hospital, in Sanji Hospital. And that's the operating room. Now, if you can imagine a hospital without doctors or nurses, that was what this hospital was. And these are medical assistants who are paramedics who dispense medicine. These are health assistants who are the public health people, and they're inspecting meat here at the market. This is the guardian shelter. People who had relatives that stayed in the hospital who came from maybe many miles away would need a place to stay. So this was the open-air guardian shelter, and they would cook their food and stay with their relatives. This is a rural dispensary. I had six rural areas that I would serve with, and this is another one. I had a motorcycle, so I traveled around and checked the medication records of all of these. That's our ambulance. And this is the first house I lived in Malawi. Not lived in, but when we were given another month of training in Malawi, we were set up to stay with the host family. And, of course, right away we're thrown into a cross-cultural thing. We're going to stay overnight in this village called Namitambo. And I guess we got to quit here. We're almost done. I'll let it go, and then we'll see the end of this, and then let's just let it go. This is a scene inside an Nsanji village. Got about a minute here. That's a Sena house. The people I work with are called the Sena, and that's a unique architectural style they had for their houses. It's another village scene. And this is how some women would wash their clothes in the river. And some women would get their water from water holes like this or bore holes, and then they have to carry it back to the village. This is a local craftsman making using a loom. This is a friend of mine named Tom Shoes who made ebony candlesticks to sell. This is local music. I had a going away party, and they brought it for the villages that I worked in, and they brought in musicians that would play for it. And this is the set of drums from a master drummer called Simon. And I bought these drums, and this is my going away party. There I am sitting there. And I bought these drums, and I made a deal with that's beer they're brewing. That's a lot of beer. And I liked beer. This is me at the railroad station in Nsanji bringing all of this material because I had a month's home leave, and I went to the Field Museum in Chicago and asked them if they had anything from Malawi, and they said no. I said, how about if I collect some stuff for you? So I bought Simon's drums and all his pottery, and I kept a couple of things, but this stuff is now in the Field Museum in Chicago. And I guess that's pretty much the end. I went over a little bit, didn't I?
Tom was worried whether he could make more than 10 minutes. I told him he had a lot of material. If the ushers would come forward and take up a collection, we're going to then hopefully pepper Tom with a few questions. If you don't, I might bring up a couple I know. And come forward and take up the collection. We invite you to come to the mic if you have questions, and please, everyone gets to ask a question first before the second one. And we're asking questions as opposed to speeches. Please go to the microphone and speak clearly. Tom, it's yours again.
Okay.
You spoke initially about going to Malawi to be engaged in a research project, incidence of TB and kinship groups, as I understood it. What was the result of that research, or what was the major finding?
Well, it turns out after 4 months of training, they brought over doctors from the public health school in North Carolina who were going to run the project. And we spent hours coding this. This is pre-computer, so we used all these sheets coding familial data. And then that was going to be taken back to the University of North Carolina and analyzed. Well, it turns out the goals of the university were different than the goals of the Peace Corps. They saw us as a research project. Peace Corps saw us as a resource that could be used by the local people. So there was kind of a falling out, and eventually North Carolina pulled out of it. And so we were left taking care of patients in what's called intensive areas. I worked in two villages. I delivered medicine to the people in the villages. And so for the remainder of the time in Malawi, we became a service for the Ministry of Health.
Explain a little more about the utilities you had available to you, like water, electricity, that sort of thing.
Oh, the local people? Or myself?
Yeah.
I've lived in three different locations in Malawi. The last one was in the town called Mlanje, which you saw the picture of the mountain. And I had a small house there, and of course nobody locked their doors. One day I heard this clucking, and a chicken came in and laid an egg for me. But I didn't have running water or electricity in that particular house. But the other two houses I lived in, one had electricity. Oh, actually, I had two different houses in Sanji, and we had electricity and running water. In a town I lived in Chiradzulu, we didn't have running water or electricity, and there was an outhouse in the back. And most people don't have running water. They have to bring water in from very far away from a borehole, which is like a well that's been dug, or from the river, which is not very sanitary.
To what extent were you perceived as outsiders, and did that complicate your work in terms of trying to gain people's trust so you could be effective?
That's a really good question, because Malawi had a tradition of sending its workforce to South Africa. And at that time, South Africa was an apartheid government, and the men couldn't bring their families. They had to stay in dormitories, and they were away from their families and forced to, well, at very low wages, work in the mines in South Africa or in Rhodesia. And so their contact with Europeans or white people was limited to the contact they had in South Africa or in Rhodesia. So the main thing to overcome was, since I could speak the language, or was learning the language every day, was this perception of white people as being kind of racist. That was something to overcome. And at the time I was there, there was a vestige of this in the Mlanje headquarters in the government building there. They had what they call district commissioners, which are like governors of states. And they still had a white one there, a white governor there, or white district commissioner. And I remember going up to his house to meet him, and the comment he gave me was, "You know, in the old days, we used to have a sign that said, 'Africans and dogs keep out.'" So, you know, that really disturbed me. I went to the Peace Corps director and talked to him, because I hadn't really been confronted with this kind of race. Well, I'd seen racism in the United States, but this was so obvious. And we kind of let it go. But the idea was, people are people. These are some of the most friendly people in the world. Some of the poorest people in the world are willing to share with you their food, even their house. You can stay there if you need to. And me being able to speak some of the language was a great plus. In fact, one of the greatest funny things I enjoyed was when I would speak something and they would say, "Ah, Akwadziwa," and then they'd laugh. And that means, oh, he knows. So, you know, I got an insight into the culture that, you know, a lot of Peace Corps folks end up teaching in schools, which is a very different experience than the one I had, because I was working day to day in villages and in the hospital. And in order to carry out what I needed to do in the villages, I really needed to communicate with people. So,
thank you very much. This is going to be a question about the use of natural resources, but let me give just a little bit of background material. In about 15 years ago, I was visiting the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and there was this huge architectural demonstration display which showed really contemporary and energy-efficient structures next to pictures that were a lot like the structures you showed in your slides, using the earthly wisdom that had gone into the structures in Africa to build structures in other parts of the world that were also energy efficient. Do you know anything about that? Can you comment on it?
Well, we did have, there are projects in Peace Corps that deal with that, and it was something called appropriate technology, something that's appropriate for the culture that people can carry out. And there have been a lot of horrible things that Europeans did in various things, being miscommunicating to a culture. And in fact, one of the worst ones I can think of is Nestle, who dressed up nurses, who dressed up saleswomen as nurses and went around to villages in Nigeria trying to convince people they should buy infant formula. Well, people in the world want to be modern. They want to have the latest stuff, the latest technology, and a lot of women bought into that. Problem is, how do you sanitize the water that you mix with the milk? As a result, this was a great scandal for Nestle, and they've kind of swept it under the rug, but a lot of kids died because there was not the appropriate technology to help use the formula. And so that was an example of, just like the example of Livingston not knowing what the lake's name was and eventually naming it Lake Lake. Okay.
You went over with a team, you said. Were you by yourself, or was the team also in the same location?
Oh, in Nsanji, there were Peace Corps teachers. I think there were three or four of them. For a while, I had a roommate, and we worked together in the X-ray department of the Mlanje Asanji Hospital. In my last year, I lived alone. So it depends on the situation you're in. Usually, the government will provide you a house. And of course, at that time, I got the outrageous sum of $90 a month to live on. But when you figure out people were making less than $100 a year, that's an astronomical amount of money.
What resources did you have from the Peace Corps in order to function? I know you got training at the University of North Carolina, a certain kind of training in the country, but I mean, how did you survive and contribute to society during the 3 years you were there?
Okay, well, we were given a subsistence allowance, like I mentioned, which allowed us to buy food, and of course, most people had employed a cook or who also helped keep their house together because you were working and didn't have stoves and stuff like that, or the technological stuff that we take for granted here. The University of North Carolina provided us with training, and basically we were whatever thing you were involved in, you were attached to the appropriate ministry. The Ministry of Education would provide for your services that you needed to function. I worked with the Ministry of Health. So I didn't really get any outside resources, except I was taking x-rays for about a year with Madame Curie's, looked like Madame Curie's original x-ray machine. It was so old. And so I expressed to the Peace Corps, hey, unfortunately there was a lead apron, but the exposures were a minute long. You know, today people freak out if it's over, you know, a millisecond for an x-ray. But anyway, I did ask for Peace Corps to provide me with a radiation badge to make sure that I wasn't being overexposed to the x-rays. But as I said, it was something that changed my life totally. And after I came back, I enrolled in Ohio University Center for International Studies. And having so little knowledge of Africa before I went over, I decided to enroll in African Studies. And I spent a lot of hours, and I eventually got a master's, but I learned the politics, I learned the culture and the history of Africa by going through that program. Then after that, I decided, okay, Peace Corps is something that can change perceptions of the world by our country. Right now, we've got kind of a situation where people are, where people in power are calling the people the other, and we should be afraid of these immigrants. We should be afraid of these countries, and so on and so on. The hope for the world is getting people into cross-cultural experiences that will help share their knowledge and the knowledge from that culture. I think the most significant thing that happened was when I came back and was able to share some of the knowledge about that I learned about Africa. When I came back after finishing the degree in Ohio, I went on to become a Peace Corps recruiter and then a public affairs specialist for Peace Corps and VISTA, which was Volunteers in Service to America, which was a domestic Peace Corps program. And in some ways, VISTA seemed to be a harder program than Peace Corps, because you go to another country and you have all these experiences. When you're a VISTA volunteer, you're home. You're not going to go home, because this is your country. And if you're trying to change the culture, it's really hard to do. I don't know, I could go on for another hour or two talking about stuff. But I don't know. Any more questions?
I think this will have to be the last one.
Just real quick. Okay. I just want to make a comment. I was 63 to 65, Peace Corps, Rio de Janeiro, public health. And everything you say about the experience, I just ditto. The value of it and the need for it. And I also certainly emphasize the difficulty in being a VISTA volunteer. Much more difficult than those of us who got to go abroad. You know, you could walk into any office and they would honor you and listen to you, and the poor VISTA volunteers couldn't even get into the mayor's office. So I really commend VISTA. I loved my Peace Corps experience.
Thank you.
Thank you to Tom for sharing some of this morning, and having spent some time with him, he's right. He could talk for another couple hours and tell you a lot more about it. I understand that he is, and he didn't speak to this much, he has stayed in touch with people who've served in Africa after his time, so he is somewhat more current on what is going on. That we have to provide you an honorarium,
thank you.
American-made.
I'm going to use it right
union.
Away.
Thank you. And thank you for being here. Tom does have a program on KKFI a little bit later this afternoon, but said he could stay around for maybe half an hour.
Sure.
And talk with anybody who'd like to ask more questions or details or make connections. So he'll be down the hall to the church library, I believe, coat room, meeting room, library, on the way. I think there'll be a sign outside the door. Next week, the forum will be Joe Spees of the Kansas Sierra Club talking to the history of the Koch brothers and their efforts to stop clean energy. That might be of interest to some of us. Hope to see you next week, and thank you, Tom, very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, What Do You Know About Africa? With Tom Crane. This program was recorded on Sunday, September 14th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.